This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy birthday, Philip Roth. Okay, we know Roth's 75th birthday was actually last month, but today is the big birthday tribute at Columbia University, organized with the Library of America and the National Book Foundation. We're going to do our part by listening back to highlights of our interviews with him. Roth is one of the most honored living American writers. He's won all the big prizes, starting with his first book, Goodbye Columbus, which won a National Book Award in 1960. At the end of that decade, he became a popular success with Portnoy's Complaint, a comic novel about a young Jewish man's neuroses, sexual obsessions, and problems with his parents. It was a new kind of novel of Jewish identity. We're going to start with the interview I recorded with Philip Roth in 2005, after the Library of America published the first volume of his complete works. That volume includes Portnoy's Complaint and Goodbye Columbus. Let's start with your first book, Goodbye Columbus, published in 1959. Now, the novella in this book, it's like a novella and short stories, the novella in this book has so much to do with class. You know, the main character comes from a very working-class family in Newark, and he falls in love with a suburban girl, a Jewish girl, who seems to be from another world because, you know, she plays tennis, she wears cashmere sweaters, and it's a world that I think in some ways seems less intellectual, more materialistic and shallow, but it's still so attractive to him. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about what encountering that class meant to you when you were young?
Well, I think...
Because you came, like your character, from working class Newark.
Yeah, that's right. Not from the fancy suburbs. I think when you're young, a class comes as a great surprise. Most people, I guess, begin to run into it as a surprise when they go to college, because in grade school and high school, you're usually with boys and girls who are from your own background. But when you go to college, there's a mix, and you meet people who are either poorer than you were or richer than you were. And I think one is very sensitive to that as a young person, someone between, say, 17 and 22 or 23. So, and I was not unusual in that respect. I too, was stunned by wealth, or what seemed to me to be wealth, and the differences between the way the wealthy lived, or the privileged lived, and the way we had lived. Not that I ever thought of my own background as poor. I think we were, actually, but I never experienced it that way. The house had everything I ever wanted, and the neighborhood was more or less homogeneous. But I think classes comes as a great shock, yes.
Perhaps the most talked about scenes from Goodbye Columbus have to do with the diaphragm. There's a scene in which the main character convinces his girlfriend to buy a diaphragm, and she says, why do we need it? You know, we're careful. And he says, for pleasure, and it becomes clear he's talking about for his pleasure, because, you know, he'd prefer to use that instead of a condom. And they argue about this a little bit, but they finally, agree mm-hmm. to go to the Margaret Sanger Clinic, which she's heard about through reading Mary McCarthy books.
mm-hmm.
And it seems very groundbreaking at this time to write about a sexual relationship in this kind of candid way, to actually address that birth control exists and that there are different kinds of birth control methods and that there are relative merits and disadvantages of each one. Did you feel like this was, you know, outside of Mary McCarthy, entering mm-hmm. new territory?
It just seemed to me to be what was. That this is all takes place before Roe v. Wade, you know? There was no legalized abortion. Young men and young women were extremely concerned with the young woman not getting pregnant because there was no recourse. Recourse generally in those years was marriage, especially between middle-class kids. So it was a crucial issue because there was no remedy short of something drastic, which was either marriage for very young people or an illegal abortion, which was quite terrifying if one even knew how to go about doing it. Therefore, there's a certain weight to that discussion that probably the book doesn't have any longer for contemporary young people. But at the time, it was truly a monumental subject that arose between a young man and a young woman.
Well, also one of the first things she's asked when she calls the clinic is she married? I mean, it was a really big step for a young woman then who was not married to go to a clinic and admit that she was having sex.
Absolutely. It may seem like a small thing now, but it really wasn't a small thing for Brenda, coming from her background, to do. It wasn't a small thing for him to ask her to do. It wasn't a huge thing, but there's a ripple on the surface there. Of course, they're undone by that because, as I remember, correct me, Terry, you read this.
Okay.
I haven't.
Go ahead.
I'll try.
I'll grade you on your accuracy about your own book.
Well, if I had written the book, I would have the diaphragm discovered by the mother who, because between the mother and the daughter in that book, there's a certain amount of hostility, ordinary sort of hostility between mother and daughter at that age. But the mother, I believe it's the mother, finds the diaphragm. And precedes the sort of argument that ends their affair. And Brenda feels that she can't, having been revealed, having had her true sexual nature revealed to her family, she becomes timid, or you might say she becomes sensible. I don't know. I don't interpret it myself. And she says to him, we can't go on with this. They don't. So the diaphragm isn't introduced in the story just to have the requisite diaphragm in the story. But the story turns on that decision and is resolved because of that decision.
And they both judge each other by how they've handled this.
Mm-hmm.
She judges him for bringing it up. He judges her for having left the diaphragm at her parents' house while she goes to out-of-town college, left it in a place where it could easily be discovered. And, in fact, it is discovered. Their personalities, the ways of looking at each other, are all revealed through their behavior around the diaphragm. Now, you're pointing out that this was no small thing for an unmarried couple in the late 1950s when the novel is set. Was it a small thing or a big thing for your publisher to have so much of the characters of these two people revolve around birth control?
No, not at all. It wasn't, I wasn't Henry Miller. It wasn't so taboo. The moment had come where one could do this without being alarmed. I wasn't offending the respectable. Or I didn't think I was. And nor did Houghton Mifflin think so. So, no, they behaved admirably and like a good publisher.
Let's move on to Portnoy's Complaint, which is a book that so defined you. In the first part of your career, it was published in, was it 1969?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 1969.
And the book is a novel, but it reads almost more like a really long riff on the subject of a young man breaking away from an overprotective mother and a kind of ineffectual father and becoming... it was very absorbed, if not obsessed, with his own sexuality. That's kind of generalizing much too much and over-reducing.
No, I would just add, Terry, that it's told in the form of a monologue delivered to a psychoanalyst. And since sex is a central subject in psychoanalysis, that's why they're talking about it. He's not in a bar or in a classroom. So that's very important where it takes place and to whom he's speaking.
So what made you want to write it in that voice of, like, basically a long confession and complaint to a psychiatrist?
Mm. Well, can I tell you a little bit of the history of how the book was written?
Please.
And I think that'll answer the question. In between 1960 and 1962, I was making a living by teaching in the writer's workshop in Iowa City. And I had among my students some Jewish students, and almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them at one point write a story in which there was an overbearing mother and an ineffectual father and an angry daughter or son, depending upon the sex of the writer. And I saw this thing repeated over and over again, and I thought, I'm face to face with folklore. This is a legend, a true legend perhaps, but the backgrounds of these people, and they were probably people born in 1940, I wasn't much older than they were, the backgrounds of these people all lead them to this legend. And I was impressed by the story. So I began by writing a short story, which I called A Jewish Patient Begins His Analysis. And it was published in Esquire magazine. And what I'm trying to get to is that there was not so much forethought in my writing this book, nor did I know beforehand what the hell I was doing. After I wrote that, I thought, go ahead. You found something there. What had I found? That in talking to the invisible analyst, or at least using that as the conceit, I had opened up my verbal floodgates, you know, that I could go further. Not only that, but that the psychoanalytic session gave me permission to speak freely of sex. At any rate, I wrote this story about the character talking to his analyst about masturbating. And nobody wanted to publish that. And except a very unlikely magazine for me for that story, which was a very elite journal called The Partisan Review. And the response to that, which was tremendous, though it was a magazine with a circulation of no more than 2,000, I think, and I think I got $50 for it, that prompted a tremendous response from people around me, people in New York. I was living in New York at this time, who read it. And that was when I was encouraged to go all the way with the book and say, okay, you've got the beginnings. I had to rewrite bits of the first two chapters once they became chapters rather than stories. But this is the way to go. You're free. Well, there's no two words are more precious to a writer, I mean, than you're free.
This book also became famous because of what it said about Jewish middle-class life or Jewish working-class life. Like, for instance, in writing about his father, he writes, he drank, of course, not whiskey like a goy, but mineral oil and milk of magnesia and chewed on Ex-Lax and ate all bran morning and night. He suffered, did he suffer, from constipation. And the sense of, you know, that like his father wasn't like macho, like, you know, he didn't drink whiskey, he drank milk of magnesia. I mean, that's one of the themes through the book, and the sense of like some things are goyish and some things are Jewish, and some of the things that were goyish, not Jewish, seem much more desirable and exotic and romantic and manly and so on. And of course, you took a lot of heat for that, you know, from Jewish critics and Jewish readers who felt, you know, that you were insulting your own Jewishness and other people's too. Were you prepared for that? And was that something that you were concerned about at all in writing it? Or did you just want to like get that voice right?
With Portnoy's complaint, I can't say that I wasn't prepared for something because it was obviously looked at one way, an act of provocation. But I just wrote it out, really. It was very fierce. I was called a lot of disgusting names that were false. I was called a Jew hater. I was called an anti-Semite. I was called a self-hater, and so on. This was offensive to me. Remains the people who made those comments remain offensive to me. I think I was talking about something that was, which was this kind of rage existed. This kind of defiance existed. This kind of anguish, by the way. I think one thing that's in the book that must be noted is the anguish of this character. This comedy is a form of suffering. And otherwise, I wouldn't be interested in it. It wasn't just a kind of stand-up routine or anything like that.
We're listening back to an interview with Philip Roth from September 2005. We'll continue our celebration of his 75th birthday with more interview highlights after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's great to be able to talk about a book you love with someone else who's read it, but it's particularly great to hear the author talk about it. And that's what we have the privilege of presenting on Fresh Air, emerging authors as well as our greatest living writers, like Philip Roth. Public Radio is a literary oasis on the radio. I hope you'll support it with a pledge. Thank you. Let's get back to our 2005 interview with Philip Roth. When we left off, we were talking about the book that made him famous, Portnoy's Complaint. Part of what made it famous was his portrayal of an overprotective, domineering Jewish mother. Was your mother prepared for it? Because so many people must have assumed that the mother in your book was based on your mother. Mm-hmm. And so many Jewish mothers who didn't even read Portnoy's Complaint were offended by it. Mm-hmm. So how did your mother handle it?
I'm good at offending people who don't read the book. That's probably the strongest thing I do. Well, my mother and father were pretty good. I have to tell you, I had to prepare them. I felt I had to prepare them for the publication of this book. That was not something I had done with the previous three books. But before Portnoy's Complaint, I did have to prepare them, I thought, because it became clear as publication came upon us that it was going to be a big book. And we had lunch, and I said, look, this book is going to come out, and it's going to, appears as though it's going to cause a sensation, because it has the following ingredients in it. And I told them what they were. I said, and you are going to be telephoned by journalists, and you have no experience with that, and I want to prepare you for it. Number one is you don't have to talk to anybody. You can politely hang up or unpolitely hang up. They're just journalists, you know? And they'll be very nice to you, and they'll say flattering things to you, try to get you to talk, but you don't have to. I said, if you want to talk, that's fine with me too. But I want you to know you don't have to, and that you won't give offense to anyone if you don't. And you may be well advised not to, but it's finally up to you.
So did they?
Well, the story is better than that.
They
left the restaurant, and I didn't know this till after my mother died. My father and I were taking a walk. We took many walks after that, and he was telling me lots of things. They got into the taxi cab, and my mother burst into tears. My father said, what's the matter? He said, he has delusions of grandeur. and I've never known him to be like, he's not like that, but he's going to be terribly, terribly disappointed. And my father would say he knows what he's talking about or whatever. My mother said, no, I can't bear how hurt he's going to be when this doesn't happen. So that was her reaction. In fact, what happened was that they did get numerous phone calls, and they were polite and didn't say anything. I think my mother said one thing that was quoted by the New York Times. She just found it very difficult to hang up on the New York Times, you know. It's really quite easy. But she didn't know that. And she, in response to the question, the needling question about Jewish mothers and herself, she said, it was worthy of Pascal, really. She said, all mothers are Jewish mothers. That shut him up. So she was quoted. He was quoted in the New York Times as saying that. And I think there are many Christian mothers around America who may have taken real exception to that.
So I imagine that when she realized that this wasn't delusions of grandeur, that the book was not only very noticed, it was a huge bestseller, she must have been very, very proud.
Oh, they were, except they took a lot. They took a certain amount of crap from their friends about me and what a bad boy I was.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a series of lunches. And we had a second lunch about that, at which I said, when they say to you that he's, how could he write this stuff? Say to them, you don't know how bad it is. I said, don't defend me. Don't defend me, because it's a losing game. I said, Shay, you don't know what we've been through with this boy. It's been a nightmare. Now everybody knows, thank God. And so on. Well, they didn't do it. But they did, you know, people were anxious to needle them, and not everyone, needless to say. So the answer is that, yes, they were very proud. They were also confused. They were not literary people by any means. They weren't stupid, but literature wasn't part of their lives. They were confused. And when authority figures in their lives, like rabbis and so on, charged their son with being an anti-Semite, they didn't know what to make of it. And my mother did ask me, I put this line into The Ghostwriter, in fact, where the mother says to, she said, I mean, Philip, are you anti-Semitic? And I said, Ma, what do you think? No. I said, okay, you got it. You know, there it is.
Philip Roth recorded in 2005 after the first volume of his complete works was published by the Library of America. We'll hear more from Roth in the second half of the show. Today is the day of his 75th birthday tribute at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Philip Roth is getting a 75th birthday tribute today at Columbia University. We're celebrating by listening back to excerpts of our interviews with him. Our next excerpt was recorded in May of 2000 after the publication of The Human Stain, which completed a trilogy of novels about the impact of political and social events on the lives of individuals. Each of the three novels, the Pulitzer Prize-winning I Married a Communist, American Pastoral, and The Human Stain, is narrated by Roth's fictional alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman. Newark, New Jersey plays a big part in your trilogy. You grew up in Newark. What was your immediate neighborhood, your immediate culture like when you were growing up?
Well, I was born in 1933, and so I guess by about 1943, I was my eyes were open, and the war was on, World War II. And that was an overwhelming experience, though needless to say the war was not fought here, but the whole country was at war, and the mood of the country was determined totally by the war. And I felt that mood in our neighborhood, as everywhere else. My neighborhood was really a kind of Jewish village, I would say, in a city that was made up of ethnic villages. So the word ethnic did not exist. We never thought of ourselves that way. I think ethnic is a word that comes out of the 60s, really. I mean, it existed, but it was not a word that we used to describe ourselves. And so I never thought of myself, by the way, as an American Jew. I think of myself as an American or a Jewish American. These terms are utterly foreign to me. I never felt that anything but amused by designation. But you can call me a Newark Jew. If you want to. There were Newark Italians, there were Newark Poles, there were Newark Irish. I think as kids we experienced these differences locally in the city because we lived in neighborhoods that were defined in that way. And there was a certain amount of xenophobia, there was a certain amount of hostility. But once one left the neighborhood, one wasn't a Newark Jew, one was an American. So it was a Jewish neighborhood, Jewish high school, Jewish grade school, Jewish high school, Jews everywhere. Strangely, I was thinking the other day, I never saw a Jew in a skull cap on the street in my life growing up. Someone asked me about that recently. Did I wear a skull cap as a kid? I said, outrageous. I wouldn't have thought of such a thing. Nor did anybody else in the neighborhood. So here was this 100% Jewish neighborhood, and I didn't know a single soul to wear a skull cap, which tells you a lot about the fierce secularization, the fierce Americanization of my generation and my parents' generation.
Now, in some of your books, your surrogate, your alter ego, is the character of Nathan Zuckerman. And Zuckerman is now, I think, 67 in the latest novel, is that right? 65?
And this book, I think he's something like 64 or 65.
Yeah. And he's now living as a recluse, living alone in the country and writing. He's had prostate cancer, and the surgery resulted in nerve damage that left him incontinent and unable to have sex. I find it so interesting, you know, at the beginning of your career with Portnoy's Complaint, you became an author who became famous for writing a character who was so involved with sexual imagination. And now you followed a different character, the character of Zuckerman, to a point in his life where he is physiologically unable to have sex and emotionally perhaps not that sorry about it. He's sorry. He's tired of what you describe as that erotic professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why you, I realize there might not be an answer to this, but why you wanted to put him in that predicament, why you wanted to explore that kind of physiologically enforced celibacy.
Right. When I was beginning this book, or not this book, I should actually say go back to American Pastoral, because the history of Zuckerman's sexual retirement, as it were, begins with American Pastoral. At about the time I was writing that book, however many years ago it was, five or six, there seemed to me to be a kind of epidemic of prostate cancer in the circle of men who I was close to. So I knew what men went through when they went through this, and I suppose it's not too remote from what women go through with various gynecological surgeries or with a mastectomy. It's a tremendous blow. It's a very, very difficult operation physically. Forget the consequences of it. And I saw this being enacted in numerous places, and I thought, well, I've reached an age where this is now a kind of phenomenon of my generation, and so I decided to take it seriously. You know, it isn't the plague, but it did seem to me a powerful blight on the sexuality and virility, needless to say, of these men I know. It's a very mysterious and enigmatic business, sexual activity. And that's why I've been interested in the sexual lives of men. I'm not out to titillate anybody. I'm out to try to figure out what it is, mm-hmm. and to represent it as best I can.
Philip Roth, recorded in May of 2000. We'll continue our 75th birthday tribute with an excerpt of our 2006 interview with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our next interview excerpt with Philip Roth was recorded in 2006 after the publication of his novel Every Man. It begins at a grave in a rundown cemetery in New Jersey, where the main character is about to be buried near his parents' graves. The novel ends with the character's death in his 70s. In between those pages, we're told the story of his life through the story of his slow physical decline. Reviewing the book in The New Yorker, Claudia Roth Pierpont wrote, "Of all the subjects that Philip Roth has tackled in his career, the Jewish family, sex, American ideals, the betrayal of American ideals, political zealotry, personal identity, none have proved as inexhaustible as the human body in its strength, its frailty, and its often ridiculous need." The novel opens at a funeral service where we learn a little bit about all this character's connections to his family. He's buried where his parents are buried, and the cemetery is run down. You're right. Things have rotted and toppled over. The gates are rusted. The locks are gone. There's been vandalism. Now, in other books, you've written about, like, you know, the old neighborhood being run down. And this is kind of like the parallel. The old cemetery is run down. I wonder what your feelings are about cemeteries. Like, do you visit, like, your parents' graves? Do you feel closer to the dead when you're at the cemetery?
Yes, I do visit the gravesite of my mother and father. Yes, I do feel closer to, if not to the dead, to their memories when I'm there. I'm rather glad that my parents were buried in the ground in a box and not cremated and their ashes scattered somewhere. It gives me a place to go. I don't believe they're present. I know they're dead. But somehow the place has a significance. It focuses your thinking. It allows you to be alone and uninterrupted in your thinking about them and your past with them and who they were. And I don't do it more than once a year, but I do it regularly, and it doesn't mean a great deal to me.
So do you have like a plot picked out? Do you know what kind of cemetery or where you'd want to be buried?
Where would it be easiest for you to visit my grave? And I'll pick up a plot that's convenient. And we can continue this interview series on into eternity.
Oh, yeah. But do you want to be buried? I mean, I have the sense that, like, cemeteries in their own way are almost outdated, you know, because people are so scattered all over the place geographically, friends and family, and they're not tied together in a physical community anymore. And cemeteries, I don't know, they seem like you need to, like, take care of the neighborhood. You know, you go in there and it's as if, like, you bought this home for somebody in a neighborhood, and it's like, is it a nice neighborhood? Is the neighborhood being kept up? What are the neighbors like? And it's just this, like, weird way sometimes of thinking of the dead.
Well, I feel differently. As recently as last February, I guess, I visited the gravesite of my mother and father. And also buried there are many members of my mother's family, my grandmother, my grandfather on her side, their brothers and sisters, those are great aunts and great uncles. So one of my mother's sisters, and so on. So I wander around, and I find, to repeat what I said earlier, that my attention is focused by virtue of those gravestones and those dates that I see. They're very powerful. They're very powerful, those dates you see on a gravestone. It's just four numbers and a hyphen and four more numbers, but they pack a punch, you know. And especially the older parts of the cemetery, I find quite interesting. In fact, I write about that in the book. There's quite a bit of history in those gravestones. You see how long people lived in a certain era. You see, as I did, the bunching together of deaths in 1918. You realize it was the influenza epidemic. You see the graves of children and even infants, which you rarely see in our era, but they were more than plentiful, alas, in the beginning of the 20th century. So I find cemeteries quite interesting, and what isn't outdated?
There was an article about you recently in the New York Times by Chip McGrath, and there's a quote that you said to him that I really want to read here. You said, if you're lucky, your grandparents will die when you're, say, in college. If you're lucky, your parents will live until you're somewhere in your 50s or 60s. And your children will never die before you. That's the deal. But in this contract, nothing is written about your friends. So when they start dying, it's a gigantic shock. When did that shock start happening to you?
Well, probably some 25 years ago, with friends who died relatively young. But it's gathered momentum in recent years, because usually one's friends vary in age from maybe being 15 to 20 years older than you and being 15 to 20 years younger than you. So the people I knew, say, when I was in my 30s who were in their 50s, are now people in their 90s or they're dead. And those deaths begin to pile up. And the death of friends is a very, very difficult thing to come to grips with. I think I'm not the first person to notice this, by the way. There's a line in a Yeats poem where he's speaking about some of the harsher experiences of old age, and he speaks of the death of friends. So I think that it isn't so much when it began, because sure, there's someone who unfortunately dies young, but when you reach your 60s and your 70s, then winnowing out takes place.
What are some of the things that strike you as emotionally different about the death of friends than the death of family?
Well, I think we could begin with what I said to Chip. We all know that the scheme is grandparents go and then parents go. And then, as I said to him, one thing you did left out is we don't die. So, and then, but one's children certainly never go before you. That's the fairy tale. Mm-hmm. The actuality is that there's no rhyme or reason to the dying. But in my thinking, friends never figured in it. Your friends are your friends for life, as it were. You're all in this thing together. You have a kind of feeling for friends, unlike the feeling you have for family. And you're quite astonished, I think, by the depth of the feeling when someone dies. And also the re-estimation, which happens when someone dies, happens all the time with friends, I think. I don't mean that you suddenly say, gosh, he was a wonderful fellow, and I always thought he was a son of a bitch. Not that. Nothing as crude as that. But rather you suddenly see them clearly, vividly, and it's very strong medicine.
You know, in previous interviews, we've talked a lot about how you've written about sexuality, male sexuality, over the years. And many of your characters have had very active libidos. This character had a very active libido and kind of led him out of a good marriage and into a bad one. And he still has a sexual urge, but he doesn't have much of a sexual life. What was it like for you to write about this character toward the end of life, kind of taking account of what his sexual life had been like and, like, the sexual mistakes he'd made over the years and what it's like to kind of leave that part of life behind?
Well, painful, as I represent it, to leave that part of life behind. You know, Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet who won the Nobel Prize some 10 or 15 years ago, lived into his 90s. I think he only died a year or two ago. Wrote some brilliant poems near the end of his life, in his man in his 90s, and not entirely well, about his lust. There's an education in reading those poems of Miłosz, that just because when you look at this 90-year-old man, you don't see necessarily the vessel that would carry lust, it doesn't mean that the lust isn't still there. Or the great poems of Yeats about being an old man and the lust that's in him despite his incapacity. So this isn't a subject that's a new one for contemplation by a writer or by anyone who ages. I just wanted to turn my attention to it. It's part of the subject. The subject, after all, is age and loss.
Since your book is so much about mortality and one man's process of slowly reaching death, I'm wondering if you believe in that expression, a good death. Do you think that there's such a thing as a good death?
What does that mean exactly?
Well, I guess I would think that it means, I mean, to me it means probably not dying this really long, painful kind of death, but also, you know, kind of facing it with some degree of, you know, acceptance. And I don't know.
Well, I don't know that I can answer that question. Each death is different, mm-hmm. and each person suffers death differently. For some, it's physically agonizing. For some, it's not physically agonizing. I'd be hesitant about the adjective. There are different deaths, I would say, rather than a good one or a bad one. I mean, of course, I can recognize if someone's in great physical agony. That's not what one would choose. But as for the second thing you talk about, which is accepting, oh boy, that's asking a lot. You're confronting, after all, one is confronting that which one has feared all one's life. Think of all the things you feared in life and add them up and then multiply it by 1,000, and now you're confronting that. So I wouldn't judge anyone's response to dying by words like, I know you didn't suggest these words, but courage or cowardice, or I reserve judgment on that. It's the hardest thing of all to face. Didn't Henry James say when he was dying, here it is, the great thing?
Your main character dismisses religion as being superstition, as being childish. Is there any part of you that ever wishes that you were a believer, that you were like a man of faith and believed in some kind of, you know, like eternal spirit after death, and believed?
I have no desire to be irrational.
What a lot of people say would be, you know, like, well, it might be irrational, but it doesn't make it, rationality only goes so far in this world.
If only it went further in this world.
So there isn't any part of you at all that, like, wishes that you could believe.
I have no taste for delusion.
And was it always that way, that you never had a taste for
delusion? Yes.
Your parents, did they believe?
I don't know, really. They were deeply identified themselves as Jews for historical, genealogical, social reasons, and family reasons and community reasons. They were powerfully identified as Jews, but theologically, I wonder. I wonder, really. I don't know.
Philip Roth, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Philip Roth recorded in 2006 after the publication of his novel Everyman. Today, Columbia University is hosting a 75th birthday tribute to Roth. The National Book Foundation, presenter of the National Book Awards and co-presenter of today's event, has a tribute to Roth on its website. You'll find a link on our website where you can also download podcasts of our show. That's freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air. The classic 1956 film, The Red Balloon, will be released on DVD for the first time later this month as part of the Criterion Collection. By coincidence, a new film inspired by the French original is playing in cities across the country. Flight of the Red Balloon is directed by Hu Chao-shen, the acclaimed 51-year-old Taiwanese filmmaker. The film is in French and stars Juliette Binoche. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In the past few years, we've seen many pointless remakes of old movies, but what we haven't seen enough of are fictional films that engage in a kind of dialogue with the movie past. I don't mean Quentin Tarantino's amusing homages to the grindhouse ecstasies of his youth. I mean something like Hu Xiaoshen's new Flight of the Red Balloon, a masterpiece that uses as its springboard another masterpiece, Albert Lamoureux's 1956 The Red Balloon, that lyrical fantasy of a French boy followed around Paris by a devoted balloon with a mind of its own. Hu is a Taiwanese filmmaker who tells slow, meditative stories, often centering on the act of storytelling itself, his narratives looping around in time. Yet his transitions so seamless, you might mistakenly think you're watching slice-of-life realism. Many critics regard him as one of the world's greatest directors, yet his work has rarely been commercially distributed in the U.S. And the only reason you have a shot at catching Flight of the Red Balloon is that it's Hu's first film in another language and features an international star, Juliette Binoche. Binoche plays Suzanne, the divorced mother of a 7-year-old boy named Simone, played by Simone Itinieu. The boy is adrift in the world, yet Hu doesn't rub your nose in his loneliness. It takes a while to grasp that his only real connection, apart from an older sister who lives abroad, is the red balloon that follows him around. You even see it hovering outside the window of his chaos-ridden flat. The balloon's movements are set to a plaintive piano score and have the delicacy of Balinese puppetry. Its motion reinforces a feeling of life as a series of currents and cross-currents. Suzanne runs a puppet theater and chants the accompanying narration, tales of mythical characters who interact with gods and are transfigured. Yet her own life is miserably untranscendent. We see her sprawled amid piles of paper, wailing into her phone at a lover who's gone to Canada and shows no signs of coming back. Even her peroxided hair seems clenched. Binoche improvised her lines, reportedly fumbling her way along like her character. And if you think you love her as an actress, you have to see her here. She's barely controlled, yet at the height of her art. As she searches through the mess for a lease agreement with an intrusive tenant, her son practices piano off-screen. Another director might hold on him, but Hu reinforces the neglect by keeping him out of the frame altogether. To this mix comes a new nanny, Song, played by Song Fang, a quiet, attentive film student who, possibly inspired by the child in her care, decides to make her own version of the red balloon and even shoots Simone in front of a building with a huge balloon painted on its side. There's something magical about Hu's transparency. He even has Song explain to Suzanne how in her film she'll use a computer to remove the person controlling the balloon. Knowing the technology doesn't diminish our sense of wonder. The red balloon of Hu's movie has the impishness of one of the many meddlesome spirits in the films of the great Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who made Spirited Away. At the risk of overgeneralizing, The Flight of the Red Balloon brings a classical Asian point of view to Lamorisse's original, a steadiness of the camera's gaze as the character's world falls apart. It's not a detached perspective. It's merely helpless to intervene. But the very presence of that camera, both Hu Xiaoshen's and the one held by Song, the filmmaker within the film, is comforting. The camera, the balloon, both watch over the child. It's the transforming power of art that makes you look to the sky and hope.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.